Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Well, hello, hello. Jeremy originally had a fascinating deep dive prepared for this week's release, but for unanticipated reasons out of his control, he wasn't able to take us on that journey. More on that in the expansion. Instead, what you are about to hear is a previously unreleased members-only episode of Icy Ghost Ships and Madness in the Mountains. It's a classic and one of our favorite explorations in the expansion. And for all you members out there, a brand new deep dive adventure just dropped in the expansion. Night Siege, the Northern Ohio UFO creature invasion. It's a bizarre and terrifying 1980s account of a community invaded by giant red-eyed critters and interdimensional shadow entities, and one family's gunfire-filled efforts to keep them at bay. But for now, grab your snowshoes and some warm spirits as we present to you Antarctic Ghosts and Ice Madness. Phantoms of the Frozen Lands. Well, hello, hello. We're here, and we're back on the mountain.
Thank you for being here. What are we doing today on the show?
Well, if you remember in season 5, episode 24, we covered the mysterious third man factor and Arctic ghosts and strange survival. And it's kind of a follow-up to that, but with some fresh angles and a little more supernatural intrigue. Right, Jer?
Yeah, it's a little more mysterious, I think, in this one, because we're going to be exploring some lore of these kind of extreme places, the polar realities of this Earth.
Yes.
I don't know, when I was researching this episode and I was reading the third man factor, which if you guys haven't listened to the main episode yet, do that. Essentially, it's this phenomenon where people are experiencing something outside themselves or seemingly outside themselves, another human or thing, a companion that helps them out in times of major distress, extreme circumstances, desperation, life and death, survival scenarios.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the constant question that people try to dissect. Is this something that comes from the outside? Or is it some sort of internal mechanism?
Right. Divine intervention or a projection of the second self, if you will. But in researching this and aspects of reading this wonderful book that we'll have linked in the show notes, The Third Man Factor, there's part of the story that when exploring took me into this atmosphere that was very much like John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah.
Do you remember that movie, John?
Mm-hmm. I never saw it, but I know you're talking
what?
About.
What? Shut up. Get out of here.
Kurt Russell.
Oh, I was thinking The Fly.
Mr. Goldie Hawn? The Fly with Jeff
Goldblum.
Yeah.
It's like a fly.
So bad.
Great impersonation.
I know. I've never tried to do him before.
You haven't seen The Thing with Kurt Russell?
No.
One of the best. You love like puppetry and animatronics. Like, it is probably held up as this gold standard.
Yeah, oh, really?
So good.
In the horror atmosphere of the sci-fi, like stranded.
It's a research base in Antarctica.
Yeah, kind of a stranded scenario where there's this thing that is this alien entity, if you will, that's kind of infiltrated, and it can take on the form of anything. So other people, so you don't know who is the thing.
Mm-hmm. Pretty incredible. Cause this is like the first scene where you come up over the side of the snowy hill and there's a giant crater and a giant ship.
And they bring there's something at the bottom that's kind of buried in the ice, and then they bring back like an ice block of it. And that's the thing, but it thaws when no one's around because they think it's this dead thing. And but they come back like it's melted and it's gone. You don't know what it looks like.
Like Encino Man?
It's just, I think it was actually played by Brendan Fraser.
And when it transforms,
such a good movie.
So good.
I mean, that's why it was such a cool movie, especially for animatronics and puppetry, because when it transforms, it's all physically does this kind of grotesque transformation stuff. But I think I've seen clips of that part.
It's true horror. But that reminds me of this, because it's the same kind of scenario that we're going to be getting into some of the stuff when we're talking about Antarctica and some of the legends and lore of these kind of
desolate, isolated places.
Yeah, and the experiences people have of the other. The entity, and this is distinct from the third man factor in the sense that there was a study done interviewing people on the bases down there and what they were experiencing, this kind of other entity, something watching, which is different from the kind of divine intervention. Here's a friend that's helping me, you know, imaginary or not, the companion helping me save my life. This is something that just essentially like skulks and haunts and is on the edges. Anyways, it may be part of the same phenomenon. And that's kind of what we're getting into. But we're going to start it off with the atmosphere of the Antarctic, something I've always been fascinated by. You know, the ice wall theory and, you know, where Hitler survived from World War II underneath the ice, allegedly.
I think he went up there, didn't he? I thought they had that base up there, but I thought he was going to Chile or something.
Antarctica is
down on the map. You go down on the far enough one direction, you end up in the other.
South.
Right?
Well, allegedly.
Yeah.
Like Mario. But anyways, to set the atmosphere of this icy, mysterious place of Antarctica, let's roll this brief little legend here that I wrote down from newspapers at the time. The ghost ship Jenny.
In the eerie stillness of the Drake Passage, enveloped by the restless Antarctic cold, the Jenny lay imprisoned in ice. The English schooner turned ghost ship was discovered in 1840 by a whaling ship, eerily frozen in time since 1823. As the whalers approached, the icy grip of the Antarctic seemed to have protected the Jenny from the ravages of time. Her sails were tattered, but the ship appeared eerily preserved. The crew of the whaling ship boarded the Jenny, only to discover a haunting scene, the frozen bodies of the Jenny's crew, each one locked in a final, silent moment, victims of the merciless Antarctic winds. The only record of their fate was a final entry in the captain's logbook, dated May 4th, 1823. Quote, "No food for 71 days. I'm the only one left alive." Whether the danger was too great to recover the ship, or the men were too haunted by the ghastly scene, no one can say. But the whaling ship decided to leave the Jenny and her frozen crew to continue in her haunting drift and silently sail the icy waters. A ghostly relic of a perilous journey that met its end in the frozen embrace of the Antarctic.
So wait, I thought this was a ghost ship story.
So it's referred to as a ghost ship, I think.
Just because it's frozen in time? But it's not like seen floating through the icebergs or anything.
It was. Well, it was when the whaling ship came across it. It was, in the sense, it was basically a floating morgue. You know, these sailors as human popsicles standing on the deck, looking on, standing at attention as the ship passes by. Frozen for 20 years, this ship.
Because they're all on board still frozen.
Yeah, they had nowhere to go, so they just froze on the ship, and the ship just continued floating.
But it's not floating around, it's imprisoned in the ice.
No, it was moving through the Drake Passage.
The Jenny was imprisoned in ice.
As in, it was frozen.
Oh, not like it was stuck in the... Yeah. That's why it was there.
I wrote this, like, write-up of it.
Okay,
It comes from, basically, I mean, this is kind of a, not embellished, but it is a more flowerily written version. I mean, here's kind of the point. This is a legend of the place. Did this occur? There are newspaper accounts of this whaling ship written allegedly by an anonymous crewman of the whaling ship submitted the article. But the earliest known source of the story is 1841, which is years later that it was supposed to have actually occurred in the late 1770s, I believe. But then in the following weeks, this story was reprinted, the exact same text, in seven different newspapers, I think. So it's just like today when you get, you know, the local news saying, "Brr, it's a chilly Easter morning. I hope that rabbit's staying warm underground," or something. And then you multiply that between 1,000 other
outlets.
Yeah, and you realize everything's written by the same. Like it's how true is the story? How authentic is it when the same newspaper across the country, or the same story is being printed in different newspapers?
I mean, it doesn't seem unbelievable that I'm sure there were ships that were stuck in the ice a lot.
Right.
And then frozen up there.
There's another tale very similar about the Octavius, where people suggested maybe this legend came from that legend because it's a similar idea of this ship that people had come across. But the details as far as like, were they actually the crewmen on board standing at attention frozen in the ice?
Oh, I missed that part. That's pretty eerie.
In one account, one of the people who went on board to see if there were any survivors went down and saw a man writing in the log, and he tried to get his attention and realized that he was frozen mid-entry writing in the log.
Oh, creepy.
And then they found his wife in her cabin who had died earlier frozen with his dog. Everyone just popsicles frozen in place. But a lot of that is basically become a part of the story. Yeah. Urban legend kind of thing of the Arctic. But the whole point is like, even if that's coming from our innate fears of the unknown and the extreme conditions in places like this that feel so alien and dark and concerning, this is the setting where we find the people in the following story. Scientists, researchers in their laboratories.
Can you imagine being a whaler? Like that period of time of being
not only
a whaler where you're fighting giant monsters and stripping them of their skin and blubber in the middle of the ocean with hooks and 20 other people jumping on top of them. Blood everywhere. Not only that, but you're also in freezing waters. Like, it sounds like hell.
I've said this before, but sometimes I just feel like different lives on this planet we're almost like different species, especially time periods. But even now, it's just the level of experience you can have compared to us sitting in a recording studio, recording a podcast, to being a whaler.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the atmosphere now that I'm removed from it. I like imagining the scenes and
the sea.
There's some sort of dark romance about that sort of stuff. But
minus the whale murder.
Yeah.
It'd be cool if you were like out of your body, like a spirit there.
Well, that's what we do every day in our imaginations.
Where you don't have to actually feel anything.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially if you're the whale.
Like the stinging,
stinging cold.
Wet cold.
Dude. And the metal freezing to your icy hands.
And you're like, imagine the kind of, what are those things called? You get, not calluses, but on your face, like the...
Frostbite?
Blisters?
No, like blister, like, yeah.
You get trench foot.
Canker sores.
Canker sores, yeah.
What about those?
I mean, I'm sure you have stuff all over your face that's just like,
like a herpes, the
wind,
the cold,
and the salt and cold just ripping at your skin all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't walk around looking like Brad Pitt.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting that we read about in this book was something called winter over syndrome, which is what takes place when you're with a small group of people for any duration of time, really. But once you get to, when you're in an isolated location, like let's say a research center in Antarctica or something, you're with 8 people or whatever. It doesn't matter how long you're there, whether it's a week, a month, a year. But in the third quarter of that period, people start to experience depression.
It's called third quarter phenomena.
Yeah. So the monotony of the isolation, more than it is like the cold.
It's a quantifiable drop in mood and morale.
Yeah.
After the midway point. So you're there for a while, but right when you pass the midway point.
So it's like psychological totally. Then.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it can lead to, severe depression, avoidance, irritability, chronic insomnia. I can just picture people and you see that in places, in movies where they've been in places like this, even space for a long time, people start to get, attitudes with each other and this kind of darkness. And then you get, in some cases, what's called the Antarctic stare, which is where someone's just become completely dissociative. And
this is even when people are around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So so for instance, if there's victims of a disaster or war, like shock, where people just kind of go away. And this was a creepy quote.
Thoughts drift from current reality into a vague absence that even the individual cannot always recollect.
So their thoughts drift into a vague absence that they don't even remember what they were thinking about. They're just gone.
Yeah.
Their minds are gone for a while. Anyways, these are the kinds of situations. And this is the setting in which people can experience the other, this lingering entity that's similar to but distinct from the third person factor. Such is the case in our next story, also from the book.
This is a good one.
And this is called Ginny's Ghost.
4 members of the Transglobe expedition under the leadership of Reynold Fiennes pitched their camp at the foot of Rivengen Mountain on the South Polar ice cap and braced for the desolation of an Antarctic winter. They set up their prefabricated huts, insulated with nothing more than cardboard. They erected their radio hut, 50 meters from the generator hut, which itself was 25 meters from the main hut that would serve as the expedition's winter home. They secured radio masts against the blasts of wind, and by the following month, February 1980, they were ready for the onset of the Arctic winter, with its 24-hour night and temperatures that plunged to minus 45 degrees Celsius. Here at the edge of the Antarctic Plateau, some 480 kilometers inland, they would have to withstand winter's assaults for 8 months before Fiennes could attempt what had been done only once before and cross the continent of Antarctica, part of a longer journey around the world on its polar axis, using surface transport only. As base commander and radio operator, Fiennes' wife, Virginia Lady Fiennes, called Ginny, was the expedition's conduit to the outside world. She was slightly built, spirited, and resourceful, and had the ability to, quote, make big men quake in their boots with a flash of her bright blue eyes. When ice buildup on the antennas, coupled with the fierce winds, tore the 60-centimeter-long metal screws from the ground, allowing the antennas to flap freely, Ginny Fiennes was the team member responsible for the repair. She struggled tirelessly and without complaint in the blizzards, a flashlight in her mouth, untangling wires. With time, the constant demands caused her to get overtired, and the hours spent alone, outside in the darkness, and inside in her cramped radio hut, contributed to a general feeling of unease. In the frequent blizzards, she often had to drag a sledge loaded with recharged batteries to the hut from her living quarters, while clipped to a safety line. The relentless cold and wind and the uninterrupted polar night, either pitch black or lit faintly by the aurora or by moonlight over the many months, compounded the agitation and introversion that accompanied their profound geographic isolation. In May, another team member, Oliver Shepard, mentioned casually to Ginny that he had heard footsteps following him from the generator hut. He attributed this to his imagination, but he was not the only one who experienced a sensation of unseen company. At one point, Fiennes herself came into the main hut and told her husband, quote,
"There's something there."
He protested, but she insisted,
"I don't mean a danger, but a strong presence."
The sense abated, and the situation returned to its routine. But then during a storm in June, she again felt something close at hand. Quote,
"It came round behind the radio shack and followed me back down the tunnel."
The entity was not menacing, but it was unsettling. Randall Fiennes believed his wife was, quote,
"frightened that she might see it."
He started accompanying her, hauling the sledge, and would stay in the radio hut with her. He never encountered anything, and she never felt the presence when he was with her. However, the stresses were only compounded as the Antarctic winter wore on. In October, Fiennes described Ginny as, quote,
"dog-tired and hallucinating. From time to time, she heard crying in the darkness and someone whispering indistinguishable words from close behind her."
By October 29th, the worst weather had passed, and Ralph Fiennes' three-man team set off using snowmobiles on the Antarctic crossing. Ginny Fiennes and Simon Grimes, who had flown into Rivengen Camp, remained behind temporarily to maintain the vital communication link until a planned relocation. The camp now also served as a base from which air support could haul fuel for the snowmobiles as the expedition neared the South Pole. At one point, Grimes went alone to visit the radio hut, which was then in the process of being closed up. He wrote in his journal, quote,
"No sign of Ginny's ghost, a presence which she felt during the winter. A youngish man, I gather, not malevolent, just there. The long solo nights in the hut must have enhanced her perception,"
end quote. Grimes described it now as a, quote,
"empty hut with an aura.
I sealed it up, as I knew I would not want to go back up there." Before he left, he noticed some graffiti that Ginny had scratched on the wall using three different pens at different times, he presumed. He found the words, quote,
"they're scaring, in a way. As whistlers and gibbons' cries screech in the ears, the ghost of Rivengen burst into tears. Why have you come to disturb me? After all these many years, I will haunt and I will taunt you and drive you away.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst, so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. Initial Quality Study Award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
It's unsettling. Yeah.
I don't think my mind would last long in that situation.
Yeah. We're not built for that. No. Even though our ancestors kind of were in the colder.
That's true. All those Laplanders.
We're just not conditioned.
Actually, you know, they would go on ritualistic walks out into the tundra to experience changes in perception. You know, much like Native American tribes do their spirit walk kind of thing. You deprive yourself, you know, fasting and all that stuff. Yeah. So that's a deep in our blood. So we should try it.
Yeah. Now my hands get cold when the heat's off.
That's true. It's a true story.
It's so cold.
Your internet's down. It's like, God damn, what do I do?
No, we're pretty tough. Some of the toughest boys we know.
Sounds very tough.
It's like grease tough.
Yeah. Snapping your fingers, doing the dance.
Da, na, na, na.
You want trouble, buddy? Let's go.
I'm a Laplander.
I'm gonna do my spins around you. I'm a Laplander.
That's great.
But that scene just in, like, being in that radio hut, isolated by yourself for so long, just reminds me of, and again, John, watch The Thing. Because that's...
Yeah. What, watch it together.
I think Kurt Russell's role in that, I think he is operating the radio. I know it might have been inspired partially by this.
That's what I was thinking.
Because it happened... When did that movie come out? Because this was in 1980. I think The Thing was like... Was the very beginning of the 1980s?
81, maybe.
81?
82.
So it definitely could have been inspired.
Yeah. I do love that, especially in film, that isolated kind of, you know, a crew.
Some people are kind of hanging on psychologically.
Alien,
a little bit.
Event Horizon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have to, like, work together with these different personalities, these people. At the same time, you're also trying to keep it together because you're in these extreme conditions. You're alone together.
Many a good sci-fi movie have been made with that isolated crew.
Yeah.
Mentality.
Alien.
I just said that.
Oh, okay.
I said Alien and Event Horizon.
Yeah.
Alien. It's okay. I don't listen to you a lot either.
I was going to say.
You know, Geiger, the guy who wrote this book, he actually brought that up. He said, as humanity gets further into space exploration, what a more isolated place to maybe have this sort of third man effect. Start to see more examples of that, because the more extreme conditions and the more isolation you have. And what better way than like a trip to Mars, where you might have situations to explore.
Do you guys think we'll ever do that?
Go to Mars?
Do you think humans will ever go to Mars?
I think so.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But I want to believe that we will.
How do you think we'd have to find another method of propulsion, right?
Or some sort of freezing, like you see in sci-fi films.
True. Or you could astral project there, if Mars is even real. I mean, there's a lot of questions.
I'm physically.
I just want to know if we're going to get over the ice wall, frankly.
Get Musk on it.
I don't think he's looking.
Anyways, let's get back to the show.
Bring it back in. This is a crazy synchronicity. I think about it. We were talking about the setting, and you're talking about Alien, and the book is written by John Geiger.
Oh, yeah. Like Geiger, the artist.
I wasn't sure how to pronounce his name. I thought it might be Geiger.
Geiger designed the Alien, a really incredible fantasy sculptor, illustrator, German guy.
What was his name?
H.R. Geiger.
H.R. Geiger, that's right.
Have you ever seen his house? He had a whole, like, tram system. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. It
takes you back into like a
backyard,
like a sort of alien womb. All this stuff is very like kind of sexual.
Yeah. He is definitely, his art is just wild.
Crazy.
Pretty dark.
And very sexual.
I know. What goes on in his bedroom?
That brings us back to...
He's a weird looking dude.
We actually had this whole conversation already.
Oh, yeah, we did.
But we got to have it multiple times before it really sits well.
I think it was on the Movie Curses
Train Station expansion episode.
Was that what it was?
Yeah. Pretty sure.
Oh, Train Tracks of Terror? That was an interesting conversation about Geiger. But that brings us back that feeling, the alien kind of scenario in this kind of together alone situation. small groups of people working in these places. There was a psychologist, a young psychologist named Jane Michelin, might be how you pronounce it, in 1986, who actually conducted an interview of men living at the Argentine Antarctic base of Esperanza. And she was kind of studying like human responses to living in a polar environment, as well as other extreme conditions. Mm. But the interviews took a strange turn when the men started bringing up what they were calling a, quote,
presence at the base.
Something they had apparently been encountering the 4 months previous to her arrival there. One after another, they slowly started confessing to her that they'd become convinced of the presence of an unseen being at the base. And this is a weird characteristic that I found particularly curious. The being was always encountered at the building that housed the power plant, the energy station.
Oh, interesting. That is,
for some reason or another, there was this energy source here, and this is where they're experiencing this other, this entity. Was it the effect of whatever energy was there on the people's psyches, or was this thing drawn to the energy, or perhaps living in it? You know, what is this thing? Anyways, I just found that curious. But these guys were staffed on rotating 24-hour shifts on the base, and most of the building was made up of isolated structures, and the power plant was the most isolated. Encounters usually occurring at night. One of the soldiers described being overwhelmed by a, quote, strong sensation of being observed by somebody, despite being alone in the building. Another 27-year-old mechanical technician felt certain that he was being watched through a window.
Yuck.
He said, quote,
I was alone, and the perception was so strong that I went outside of the building to check if somebody was there. No one was.
On another occasion, however, he did actually see something, very fleetingly, a, quote,
human form,
and he was male. Another man had a similar experience. Quote,
I saw somebody watching me. When I stood up myself to go there, the image moved and disappeared out of my visual field.
So what is this thing that people are seeing down there?
I mean, it kind of sounds like the third man effect, right?
Except in the third man effect,
there's a benevolence,
a communication, a companionship, a feeling of connection to this thing, this divine angel, guardian angel, whatever you want to call it, helping. This is just an unsettling, not necessarily scary presence, but an awareness of this other that's there watching. It's just a weird distinction there. And the psychologist would refer to it as, quote,
presence hallucinations.
And she would collect it from Brazilian meteorological personnel stationed in remote tropical islands, as well as the Chilean Antarctic crew.
Hmm.
And this finally led to a landmark academic paper on the third man phenomena called
The Sensed Presence in Unusual Environments.
But again, this seems to be a different kind of creature, a different phenomena.
Glimmer Man.
The observation that Jane had about this phenomena was that, like the Ginny Fiennes example of this watcher, this kind of unsettling presence that maybe inspired her to write that poem about the ghost, it is unlike the third man that manifests in these life-threatening situations.
Quote, in no case was there any communication between the observer and the entity, not any feeling of receiving help.
I guess it is, an important distinction.
Yeah. So what is this, if it's not? Or is it an early version of the third man that might come out when you are in a need of rescue?
Well, here's an interesting thing I was thinking about. If it is an internal mechanism that you get to that isolation or that dangerous life-threatening situation, does it maybe not just click and then you have this inner hallucination of something that helps you, but is it opening up what we always talk about, like that filter? And so maybe there's a benevolent thing that comes to help, but also maybe there's other things that you might experience in that state. Just a thought to consider. Maybe it's not always that benevolence. Maybe there is some other, in some other spectrum of reality that you're suddenly aware of, whether it's good or bad.
Something watching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the darkness.
Positive or negative. And it's interesting, John, have you ever done an isolation tank?
Once.
How was it?
It was interesting.
Would you do it again?
Yeah, definitely.
I've always wanted to do it.
You know, that Marigold place?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the one that I went to wasn't actually like an egg-shaped thing.
Right. Like
so
a tank,
Like a tank.
Yeah.
But the one they have there is like a room.
I'd rather do that.
It's like a it's really nice.
Yeah. It's isolated.
Yeah, it's completely pitch black, but it's probably the size of this space right here. And it's really warm in there.
Yeah.
It's very nice.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
That's what always freaked me out about the float tanks where it's like, claustrophobic.
I mean, if you're claustrophobic, it's probably not the best place, but I didn't get any sense of that.
But you may be able to experience something like the third man in there.
You can have some like psychedelic trips almost.
Exactly.
If you're in there long enough.
And I find it interesting because this book was written, I think, was it 2008 or something? But before like isolation tanks were really, before Joe Rogan made them very popular. Yeah. So when they're referring to it in the book, he says that scientists had observed subjects in what he was calling isolation tanks. And he was breaking it down, you know, body temperature, water. So you don't feel that. No sensory stimulation at all in the dark. And apparently at about 45 minutes in, it was recorded that, quote,
quite normal persons, robbed in the tank of all sensory cues, begin to do a strange thing. With a screen of consciousness not filled with sensory images from the environment, the individual himself begins to fill the screen projectively with his own inner, uncorrected fantasies.
And in these experiments, subjects become convinced that, quote,
someone else was in the cubicle.
You remember the movie Altered States? William Hurt? Mm-hmm. That was an isolation
tank. That's true.
1980.
I've never seen that. I've seen clips of it.
That's great. Weird.
But yeah, so I guess in the subjects they were studying, there was a certain point where people would start to sense that there was someone in there with them.
Hmm.
Whether that be actually projected from themselves.
Right.
So just fascinating. But I do think, yeah, like altered state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You could be opening up to something that is there externally or, yeah, or something that's coming from yourself. But either way.
You know, out-of-body experiences have that. We've talked about that too, where people experience that. When I had mine, I had a brief sensation that there was someone in the room and then the name Eden came into my head.
I remember that.
Before I went down the stairs.
Didn't you Google that and found it was like the first book written on OBs was, the author's name was Eden?
Yeah, there's some connection to some relative. I don't know. It was hard to find back then because it was so early in the internet days, 2006 or something. But what's next?
So an interesting connection to all the Everest conversation we had on the main feed about the climbers, the mountaineers, like, what's the fella's name?
Hillary.
I guess we didn't talk much about.
We covered him in Strange Travels, the very first expansion episode where we talked about, he pretty much broke the Yeti concept to the West, as I remember.
Okay. Sir Edmund Hillary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he was climbing Mount Everest and saw the footprints and.
Yeah. So we talked about him a little bit. So coming from Everest, he and his Sherpa Tenzing Norgay, who's important coming up here as well. In May 1935, they became the first known people to reach the summit of Everest. Super famous for that in their day, worldwide celebrities. But seeking an even more extreme exploration, Hillary went to Antarctica 5 years later. And fascinatingly, he had been inspired by Sir Ernest Shackleton, who we talked about a little bit in the main episode, who was captain of a ship, an expedition in Antarctica, and famously kind of began the concept of the third man factor when his ship was overtaken with ice and they had to get out onto the ice, and the kind of divine vision and presence that he felt there, an experience that would write about years later, became the impetus for the concept of the third man factor. Because he talked about always feeling like there was another there, a very real companion that he could count among them,
yeah,
even though they weren't there, which always reminded me, I don't know if you guys ever had this experience, but the Ninja Turtles.
Oh yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
I've had that experience.
I've had the Ninja Turtle experience.
Have you ever been like watching the Ninja Turtles when you were a kid and remember thinking occasionally like,
I feel like they're missing one.
You ever have that feeling like there should be another? Like
a fifth one?
Yeah. Like almost like a Mandela kind of feeling.
Mm.
I feel like I felt that, but I don't know if I'm just feeling it now because you're saying it to
when
my mind.
When you're here with like a group of friends, you ever get that feeling where you're like,
I feel like we're missing somebody.
You ever have that experience?
Yeah, I think so.
I guess it's kind of different.
It's a little different.
Because you don't feel an extra somebody. You feel like you're...
There should be somebody else there that's right. Not... Yeah.
But it's just the brain being strange.
The Ninja Turtle effect.
Pizza time!
The Ninja Turtle effect.
A good aside.
Let me know if you guys have experienced...
Corey Feldman. Was he Raphael? No, who is he?
Michelangelo?
I think he was Michelangelo,
in the
right?
Films?
It would make sense.
Go, Ninja, go.
Donatello.
Really?
That's right, yeah, which surprises me.
Who's Michelangelo? I mean, he's such like kind of a, you know, goofy guy.
Yeah. Oh, probably because you remember the quote from The Burbs where Corey Feldman's talking about having
pizza
dude
here.
Coming.
Yeah.
So now we're going to make a run to McD's. You want a quarter pounder or something?
Oh, no way. Hey, wait, you guys can't go now. It's the best part. I called the pizza dude.
All right.
Look, we got the pizza dude coming.
Michelangelo loved pizza.
Raphael was the serious one.
He was the emotional one.
Was serious. Raphael was like kind of he had a quick trigger. Could get angry.
Yeah, there's some emotional issues with him. It's really interesting because the film...
This is definitely a deterrent.
Anyway, that brings us back to Antarctica. Anyway.
Comforting.
Coming back from Tangent Town. We're arriving back to the original station.
Such a good podcast name.
Tandatown?
Yeah.
So where we left off was Sir Edmund Hillary, Everest conqueror, goes to Antarctica for an even more extreme experience, and he ends up at the hut of Shackleton.
Yeah. Is he one of his heroes, right?
Which was, yeah, a hero of Hillary, obviously another great adventurer explorer. And when he gets there, he records this account. So Shackleton had died in 1922 before
Hillary got there.
Before Hillary got there, obviously. So he went to the hut where I think was a place he would stay. Like, so it's not a lot of structures down there. So he would stay in older huts, mm-hmm. which is a common thing. When he got to Shackleton's hut, he recorded, quote,
"I'm not a person who really sees things very much, but when I opened the door, I distinctly saw Shackleton walking towards me and welcoming me."
Weird.
Well, that's pleasant.
So the apparition of his hero, who had died in the Antarctic a few years earlier, welcomes him to his hut. Just kind of a cool...
Yeah, that's cool.
For a guy who doesn't see things very often, he's seen Yeti footprints and ghosts of hikers, and he's got two on me.
And I should say, from what I've read of Shackleton, like, he found something really special in the Antarctic.
Yeah.
A divine connection, a star in the sky, but something that gave him this presence and warmth to help him keep going, which again is in the book, The Third Man Factor. Speaking of deaths of those adventurers and heroes, you guys remember Frank Smythe?
Yeah.
If you guys haven't heard the main episode yet, Frank Smythe was a man who had witnessed some pretty incredible things through his experiences climbing Everest. For instance, the sky whales that he came across.
Yeah.
Giant pulsating...
with the undeveloped wings?
Undeveloped winged creatures hovering in the sky watching him. Whether that was in his mind or real, something he witnessed. Towards the end of his life, it was pretty tragic. He developed cerebral malaria on the early end of an expedition to the Indian Himalaya in 1949, only 48 years old. And while he was known to be kind of like, some people thought he was an annoying kind of guy because, or they were annoyed by him because he had this kind of intense self-reliance, which some people saw as not a team player, it sounded like, some of his contemporaries. So he's dying on this plantation in Darjeeling, India. And the last person I believe to visit him was Tenzing Norgay, the Nepalese Indian Sherpa mountaineer, who I mentioned earlier. Who was
that Hillary's Sherpa?
Hillary's Sherpa and companion on the first conquering of Mount Everest. And so he, even though Frank Smythe at the time was this true celebrity, you know, a way you couldn't get celebrity now, he was a world adventurer. And there weren't a lot of people that were famous,
yeah.
obviously for obvious reasons. And he was because of what he accomplished. But sadly, over the years, he'd be eclipsed by his contemporaries and people that came after him.
You just don't hear about him now.
Yeah, you learn of Tenzing Norgay, who came to visit him when he was dying. He would eclipse him, which is kind of sad. Like, these kind of future heroes are passing by you.
Yeah.
Like, literally in India saying, you know, sorry, you're dying. And then they go on to do much better things. And you're kind of forgotten.
It's like Tesla until recent times. No one really learned about him when we were growing up.
Right.
Until he became part of popular culture.
But so the quote, when Tenzing Norgay, he writes down later this quote of his last experience with the dying Frank Smythe. Then he says,
"He was taken to hospital, and when I visited him there, he did not recognize me, but simply lay in his bed with staring eyes, talking about climbs on great mountains."
And this leads me to the concept of the demon of the desire to achieve, the evil of the guidance counselor poster. You guys remember the guidance counselor posters would say like achievement with mountain?
Oh, I thought it'd be like, hang on.
Dream to achieve.
The dream to achieve.
At any cost.
The need to have success. Yeah, at any cost. The accomplishment.
Attitude is gratitude.
Attitude? Isn't it attitude of gratitude? Anyway.
Obviously, achievement is great, but.
Well, for sure.
At the cost of others.
The main thing is the balance. And it leads to this, in part, I think, problem we have, if you think it's a problem or not. We mentioned on the main feed, the fact that Everest is littered with the bodies of the dead. More than 200 climbers are still frozen on the peaks of Everest. Another 100 have perished and have been recovered, but 200.
Yeah.
They're left where they fall. Essentially, it's too much energy. It's too difficult to bring them back. But in the show notes, guys, there'll be some images. Warning. It's not overly graphic because it's frozen people, but...
But it's still a dead person.
Yeah. It's people that have passed. For instance, on the main feed, we talked about Green Boots.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I guess they did recently remove him.
Oh.
That's good.
He was a climber by the name of Sewang Paljor, an Indian climber who died in 1996 and has been there apparently up until very recently. His body became kind of the most famous landmark, this grim monument to climbers that have died.
Well, he has that sort of 80s,
yeah, 80s
colors.
90s neon green
right,
boots.
Right, and it's stayed
preserved. It looks like he fell yesterday. John, here's a picture. This is green boots.
Weird.
It's been there since 1996.
It's definitely not graphic, but that's crazy. It's been there since 96.
Yeah.
When was that picture taken?
It looks like a stage, almost like a diorama.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just this guy leaned over, half covered in snow.
Well, when was that picture taken? Does it say?
Recently.
Why is the clothing still so perfect?
It's all frozen.
I get it, but still, wouldn't there be some sort of, I mean, the elements would, I guess if it's frozen.
Yeah, and it doesn't even look like he's, it's not, there's no ice on his.
Yeah, on his body.
On his body,
on the top part.
You're right, it's weird because it's so cold. It must be frozen inside, but it's not like he's covered in ice.
Right, yeah.
That's what's so kind of bizarre about it.
I'm sure it probably changes like the seasons and stuff to some degree, right? Like snow and wind and temperatures
sure.
do probably fluctuate. So
yeah.
maybe he's covered sometimes and.
And other times not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is haunting to see the lack
very,
of.
Definitely looks like not real.
Isn't he in a cave though?
Yeah, he's in a cave where he was taking shelter when he froze to death.
On the main feed, we talked about someone who stayed next to him one night,
yeah.
right?
So there's another fella who became another popular body up there. David Sharp was his name. And he went up in 2006. So 10 years later, next to this guy who looks like he fell there the day before.
Yeah.
Green boots. And he became one of the most infamous Mount Everest bodies.
So he basically joined him there.
Yeah. So he was going up to hike and do kind of an intense thing that I don't think a lot of people would even recommend. He was going to hike on his own. He was going to summit Everest by himself. And he stopped to rest in that cave with green boots and take some shelter, which apparently is a very common thing when people go up. They will shelter or take rest right next to green boots because it's one of the spots where you can do that.
Yeah. Easy to recognize.
Which is weird to crouch next to a dead man and take some, you know, and they're like, okay, I'm going to continue my day. Like you expect it.
Yeah.
I feel like, again, it's not because it's been a while. Mm-hmm. It would feel a little bit less weird.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
You know?
But this is the
almost
really
be like sitting next to One-Eyed Willie a little bit.
Exactly. But this is the disturbing part is that when David Sharp did this in 2006, he was there over the course of several hours before freezing to death. His body stuck in a huddled position next to green boots now.
Oh, he died there too?
Yeah. Just feet away.
Both of them are there now?
Both of them. Well, I think they just recently removed green boots, it sounds like, but maybe not the other guy. But the messed up part is that unlike green boots who had gone up unnoticed during his time because there weren't that many people hiking, 40 people passed David Sharp that day.
It didn't help.
And didn't offer any help. No one stopped because everyone was trying to get to the top.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst, so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. initial quality study award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
Yeah, that's that demon of achievement you're talking about.
Exactly. There's David Sharp.
Did they know he was dying?
Well, I think there's, you know, when someone's like
in trouble,
if you're huddled on the ground,
and no source of heat,
you would at least think you'd check in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just sad, but it's obviously something that, seasoned climbers would have a problem with, specifically Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, who we just mentioned, first to summit Everest. They must've been very old by this point, but they heard about what happened to David Sharp. And they attributed this to the mind-numbing need to get to the top. And they were very obviously upset about it. And they said, quote,
"If you have someone who is in great need and you are still strong and energetic, then you have a duty, really, to give all you can to get the man down. And getting to the summit becomes very secondary. I think the whole attitude towards climbing Mount Everest has become rather horrifying. People just want to get to the top. They don't give a damn for anybody else who may be in distress. and it doesn't impress me at all that they leave someone lying under a rock to die.
You got to think about, I mean, I kind of understand just because how much preparation and time right. it takes. And that's, you know.
But so you're making that choice.
I'm not saying it's right, yeah. but I mean, I'm sure they probably rationalize it in their head. Someone else will help.
I'm sure yeah, someone else is going to help. It's yeah. like, yeah, the common thing of like someone's getting raped or attacked in the alley and everyone just watched.
It's like this lifelong goal. And, you know, you don't get a chance to do it very often. You prepare all this time and energy right. and effort, money. And
yeah. What I'll say is a lot.
Probably like pissed. They're like, "F that guy."
Yeah, don't do this to me.
until it happens to you.
But it's a lot unlike what I see if you're watching videos of just strangers stopping to help.
Yeah.
Someone's hurt and you'll have like 15 cars pull over. Like I've been in accidents. I've seen accidents like that where people will just stop and help. So the idea that like people don't care mm-hmm. and just will pass by. I think you're right, John. In this situation, people have probably invested so much and you have the money to invest that much and you have
still.
The time.
I mean, still.
I'm saying you might be a kind of person that just keeps going. Whereas maybe everyday people might not. I don't know. There's all kinds of things
yeah,
that could go
it's
into.
Definitely not the same as, yeah, like a car on the side of the road or in yeah. an accident. I mean, it is a very extreme situation.
I think the most bizarre body that I think is still up there is this one, George Mallory. He was one of the most famous.
He's still up there?
He's still up
no
there.
No way.
One of the first guys most famous to be on Everest. 1924, he died.
It was weird how pristine, like the
yeah.
coloring
1924,
is.
So 100 years ago. That's what he looks
no
like.
No dirt at all.
No dirt on him, just...
No decay.
Very pale.
Is that
body.
His actual body?
Yeah.
Oh, wild.
His muscles are... You can still see his muscles. Everything's is perfectly preserved.
100
that's
years
crazy.
Ago.
The only thing that's fallen apart is his shirt's finally has worn away to a degree. But the colors, yeah, like the brown of his shirt is still vibrant.
It looks fake.
It doesn't look real.
It's like a dummy. Even the rope, yeah, it's like pristine.
And it was linked in the show notes, guys.
There's actual physical wear on the clothing, but no dirt. Colors are still perfectly...
Yeah, just probably wind deterioration.
Yeah.
Crazy. Just, but he's covered in kind of rocks now at this point, half of his body, the stones.
The rocks that have probably fallen down from the mountain.
It's like a husk of a human.
Crazy. Well, it's a good place for a break. I feel like I need a
break from the death.
That's why they call it the death zone.
Yeah. What do you got when we come back?
Yeah, let's take a quick break and let's lighten it up a little bit.
We've got ghost sea captains coming up. We've got plane crashes and rescue in treacherous waters. That's a pretty interesting story.
More miraculous survival.
Yeah.
And the third man coming to the rescue.
And some ghost stories.
It's going to be great.
And in the meantime, for all you members out there, or soon to be members, here's a clip of this week's members only episode, Night Siege. Ohio's Forgotten War with the Red-Eyed Others. It was about 2 a.m. on a hot summer night in these parts. Robert was watching TV when his dog started raising all kinds of hell, barking very loud, etc. Suddenly, the dog stopped barking and started crying, whimpering. Robert got up and came to the back door and stepped outside with his flashlight. At this point, the dog was trying to dig himself under the push lawnmower. Robert yelled at the dog, but it did not do any good. Then Robert happened to shine his flashlight out back by his hoist. He saw a, quote, thing, similar to a gorilla, standing right next to it. It was black, with two bright red eyes. It was looking right at Robert and started making snorting and growling sounds. Robert hit it in the eyes with his flashlight, went down and caught its teeth and face, and then started on down and caught it right in the chest. At this point in the experience, Robert thought he was going to have a heart attack. He ran back into the house, yelled to his boys to get their pants on.
Boys, get your pants on!
While he grabbed his .410 shotgun. He heard the creature start around the back of the house in a westerly direction, so he sneaked out the front door with his two boys. At this point, they could hear it hollering and screaming going down the farm field. They jumped into their pickup truck and tried to chase the creature down the road.
If you like that clip and this members only episode drop, sign up to be an expansion member for double the episodes and ad-free episodes every other week. And now, back to the show.
Thank you.
back, everybody.
Hi,
coming out of the cold.
Okay, where are we?
Ghost Captain, right?
Okay, expanding the episode further on the seas. What's this next story all about, Chris? This is more of the third person factor, right?
Yeah.
Combining with the spooky concept of a
ghost captain. This is a really cool story. This comes from Geiger's book, and it's about a man by the name of Joshua Slocum and his crazy experience when he becomes violently ill in a storm and is no longer able to captain his own ship. He's all alone, by the way. So let's hear this tale. This is pretty incredible. Joshua Slocum was sailing for Gibraltar after a brief stop at the Azores on the first leg of his attempt to become the first person to circumnavigate the world alone, when his 12-meter sloop, named Spray, was struck by a violent squall. Objects on the deck were blown about by fierce winds, quote,
like bits of sea froth.
To make matters worse, Slocum himself was taken suddenly and quite seriously ill, apparently from food poisoning. He threw himself on the floor in the cabin, not far from the wheel. Slocum then was visited by a, quote,
strange guest,
who he believed helped to steer the Spray for a 48-hour period through a dangerous storm as he lay incapacitated. Quote,
I became delirious. When I came to, as I thought, from my swoon, I realized that the sloop was plunging into a heavy sea, and looking out of the companionway, to my amazement, I saw a tall man at the helm. His rigid hand, grasping the spokes of the wheel, held them as in a vice.
Before he fell ill, the 51-year-old former Merchant Navy captain had been overtaken by a pervasive loneliness. A, quote,
sense of solitude, which I could not shake off.
He had adopted the practice of speaking out loud to himself, issuing orders as if there were a crew aboard. On one occasion, he yelled from his cabin to an imaginary man at the helm.
How does she head there? Is she on her course?
When he received no reply, he, quote,
was reminded more palpably of my condition. My voice sounded hollow on the empty air, and I dropped the practice.
Instead, Slocum spent idle time reading Washington Irving's Life of Columbus. But in the midst of the severe storm, seriously ill, Slocum became convinced that there really was someone else aboard. He described the sailor as having, quote,
an ancient cast of visage,
and thought it might be the pilot from Columbus's Pinta. Slocum's initial alarm at encountering the unexpected visitor was soon allayed by the man, who assured him, quote,
I've come to do you no harm. In fact, I have come to aid you. Lie quiet, and I will guide your ship tonight.
Enormous waves were breaking over the Spray and pounding on the ship's cabin. But Slocum was unworried. When he recovered and the storm abated, Slocum found the Spray, quote,
still heading as I had left her and going like a racehorse.
The sloop had made 145 kilometers in the night through rough seas and was still on her planned course to Gibraltar. Slocum filed an account of his bizarre encounter to the Boston Globe. It was published on October 14th, 1895, under the headline,
Spook on Spray.
Slocum wrote, quote,
if ever there was a man at a ship's wheel, one stood at the wheel of the Spray through the livelong night. No thing could be clearer to me than that.
And of the phantom sailor, Slocum said he had, quote,
the feeling that I had been in the presence of a friend and a seaman of vast experience. I'm truly grateful to the strange sailor of the night.
Slocum felt the presence of the, quote, invisible helmsman several times during the remainder of the voyage, and at one point was awakened by a shouted warning, allowing him to narrowly avert disaster during a storm off Cape Horn. Even during the last leg of his historic journey, as he sailed up the eastern seaboard of the United States towards his home port, the presence returned. It occurred last during a thunderstorm in which, quote,
hailstones were pelting the Spray and lightning was pouring down from the clouds, not in flashes alone, but in almost continuous streams.
But he succeeded in working the sloop towards the coast and escaping the worst of it. Slocum writes here, quote,
after this storm, I saw the pilot of the Pinta no more.
Crazy story. Do you think it was the captain of the Pinta?
I don't know why that. Maybe because he was reading it.
On the floor when he was sick, he was reading the about Columbus's journey.
Right. But either way, I mean, pretty miraculous that, I mean, this definitely feels more of a miraculous supernatural thing. The fact that it 48 hours through a storm ends up still on course during this time period when he's just incapacitated.
And not being, you know, you have to fight the waves, obviously.
Right. You know, it capsized.
Didn't just tumble into the water. And,
yeah.
And at the depths of the sea to join Davy Jones. Pretty amazing. Yeah. Pretty amazing tale.
Cool story.
A lot of accounts like this.
Lots of ghosts at sea.
That's why I don't go out there.
Or guardians.
Or guardians.
They're all helpful.
I don't know about that.
Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Remember those giant skeleton ghosts?
No, I'm talking about in our stories today.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
The skeleton ghosts.
That's pretty messed up.
Yeah.
With the giant dogs?
Giant hellhounds?
That's like the scariest thing in the universe.
In the entire universe.
Seeing like 10-foot skeletons and dogman running? Was it just the skeletons, right?
Well, they had massive hellhounds.
Burning ships?
Yeah, and like eternally burning ghost ships.
God, that's like the awesomest thing and the scariest thing at the same time.
Imagine that. Yeah, for those who don't know, what episode was that we were discussing? It was expansion, right?
It was Halloween, I think, wasn't it? Because we talked about it was close to Halloween.
Oh, yeah, you're right. What's next?
All right, back to another great example of the third person factor. The some could argue ghost of someone maybe that passed away on the mountain on Everest. This is called Lowe's Ghost Saves Two. This is from Climbing Magazine.
In 1985, Jeff Lowe arrived in Everest region with Earl Wiggins to attempt a new route on Pomori, 23,400 feet, and the southeast spur of Nupse East, 26,000 feet. Upon arriving at base camp, Wiggins fell sick. Lowe, impatient and eager, headed out solo on Pomori. As he made his way up, Lowe realized he had a friend with him, a ghost. The ghost gave him beta and guided him to the summit. Lowe then fell sick on the mountain, emptying his stomach of all he had and remaining unable to hold food down. With persistence and sound advice, the ghost got him to base camp. Lowe would later recount the story, not with an I, but with a we. Once back in base camp, Lowe learned that Wiggins had recovered faster than expected, and he had started up to do a new route on the mountain he just came from. Exhausted, Lowe turned in for the night, but kept hearing a voice crying, "Help!" Lowe realized that Wiggins, over a mile above him on Pomori, and far out of the range to be heard, must be in trouble. The ghost was relaying a message. Lowe roused an extremely reluctant base camp team in the middle of the night. They figured he was just delirious, and went up to look for Wiggins. In what can only be of the mystical variety, Lowe spotted a glow and found Wiggins face down in a frothing pool of vomit.
"What took you so long?"
quipped Wiggins.
Oh, so there's an example of there being some sort of like actual help.
Yeah.
You know, that secret knowledge.
You wanted more of on the main episode.
Yeah.
But it was in this story specifically. Yeah, the first guy, he noticed a ghost or something when he went up by himself.
Yeah.
And then came back wearily tired. And then, yeah, the other guy, Wiggins, went up. And then this ghost that he had previously experienced, he believes called for help because he was out of range. And so the guy who had felt that presence went up and saved Wiggins.
Yeah.
To the other disbelievers.
I mean, it makes sense. If you were a helpful spirit of some sort,
mm-hmm.
you would be in these places. Because it's the most likely that these are the places where people are going to most predictably need your assistance,
yeah.
right? I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about it that way.
And it's absolutely the kind of place where if you're in a situation where you die traumatically or you maybe have regrets or you see the end coming in a very quick amount of time, like say you die on the mountain, what are the possibilities that before you cross over, you might even want to stick around and save someone else from that fate? There is a possibility that it is a spirit.
Yeah.
Someone who passed, and not just the third man kind of projection or divine intervention.
Right.
Another example is in the form of the story I call Cave Cuddles.
Aww.
I also found this, I think it might have been Climbing Magazine, we'll list in the show notes. This is another great example of
short and sweet.
Something where it seems pretty inexplicable.
In September 1975, British mountaineers Dougal Haston and Doug Scott were forced to spend a night in the death zone after reaching Everest summit late in the day. They dug a snow hole and huddled in for the night, unsure if they would survive until morning. They soon ran out of oxygen. With no food and their butane heater nearing depletion, their situation was truly dire. Then, the inexplicable happened. Both climbers reported feeling another presence in the snow cave with them, one which not only shared its vital body heat, but also offered advice and suggestions to help the climbers stay warm and alive. Other Everest climbers, such as Peter Hillary, Lincoln Hall, and Reinhold Messner, to name a few, have reported a similar presence having come to their aid on the mountain in their time of need.
Bam. It's proven.
Body warmth spirits. I like it.
Yeah, providing body warmth as a spirit or a third man.
Guardian angel.
And the advice. This reminds me of Charles Lindbergh, who we talked about before. These entities, these wispy kind of human-like figures. We talked about in the Gremlins episode too recently, but helpful. Coming through and offering specifically advice on navigation. Things that I guess you could argue is in the person's mind already, in its subconscious, and it's unlocked through this projection, this quote hallucination, or it is something more miraculous. But that's up for you to decide, I suppose.
What's this next one here? Did this
Tiger
one...
in the Sea.
Tiger in the Sea. Yeah, let's hear this crazy tale. This is my worst nightmare. Plane crash into the shark-filled seas. No thanks. My parents were in this horrific accident and barely survived it. My mother jumped into the open ocean at night, in the middle of a storm. High waves and wind moved her away from the airplane remains quickly into what felt like total darkness. She was completely disoriented and alone. Out of nowhere, here comes this person swimming towards her and tells her,
"Follow me! Swim this way!"
My mother asks,
"Where's the raft?"
And he answers,
"The raft is this way! Follow me!"
She asked again,
"How do you know?"
And he answers,
"Trust me! Follow me!"
My mother followed him into what she said was pitch darkness, nothing to be seen or heard. After a few minutes, she told me she started hearing voices, people crying and yelling. And there's the raft. My mother asked this person,
"What is your name?"
He replied,
"They call me Toby."
She thanked him, and that was the last time my mother saw Toby. After the rescue, my parents searched through the entire passenger list and found no one named Tobias or Toby. They asked everyone rescued if they knew of a Toby. Total mystery, no Tobias, no Toby. And my mother wondered, why would someone swim away from safety into pitch darkness to rescue me? How could anyone see me? How could Toby know which way to swim? Another twist to the story is that exactly the time of impact, my grandfather, my father's father, wakes up in the middle of the night and calls my uncle. He told my uncle that something terribly wrong has happened to my parents. My uncle calls the military base my father was based at, and after a couple of more calls, he speaks with someone that was knowledgeable about Flight 923. My uncle was told that the flight departed and that they were scheduled to arrive in Frankfurt at a specific time. They had no idea of what had happened. Our family has always been amazed at this tangible fact. I believe there must be another dimension that we cannot explain, bringing these kinds of events and experiences. I was born 9 months after this accident. My parents adopted me, and my mother passed away from cancer when I was finishing high school. I found my birth mother in the early 90s. It's been a beautiful life. I know I will be shaking hands with Toby one day in the future, in this world, or the next one to come. Thanks, Toby.
So that's your worst nightmare, Chris.
Yeah.
I didn't really get a chance to set that up before the story, but
yeah.
Essentially it was a plane that went down carrying 76 people, 48 survived, but they crashed in the middle of a rip-roaring stormy ocean this plane ditches because its engines catch on fire.
Yeah, that would even worse in the middle of a storm.
Yeah, dude. So crazy waves, 76 people, around 30 of them drown. And those that survived, 48 survived a 6-hour raft float in this crazy storm.
48 in the same raft?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Giant plane raft, I guess. Yeah. Until they met up with a freighter that discovered them. But just crazy story. And it's really bizarre. I found this story extremely bizarre because it was really curious. There was a note made in a blog I was reading about it. Have you guys have probably never heard of this, obviously.
This flight?
Yeah.
No.
It's happened a long time ago, but even, what was it, the 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was odd because in the blog I read from a family member whose parents were on the flight, and they mentioned that they were all, it was odd that there was no memorial, really. Not much on the news about it. And it was all military personnel.
Oh, that's right. And their families, right?
Yeah, very strange. So the quote was,
"There was very little news of the event. Frankly, there seemed to be a whole lot of silence, considering the vast volumes of publicity given most airplane crashes at the time. Even the families of the combat paratroopers who died that night received little more than a telegram notifying them of the death of their sons. There was no commemorations or memorials."
So I was like, that's odd, especially since it was military families.
Yeah.
So I Googled, I was trying to find the Flying Tiger line. I Googled to see if they were like a military airline or something. And apparently, not specifically, but they did a large amount of military contracts specifically during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Ah.
And I came across another flight where there was an actual conspiracy that happened like a year later or a year before.
Oh, right.
Another Flying Tiger flight that went down in the ocean. I think maybe towards Germany. Anyways,
it makes you trying to cover something up.
Yeah, it makes you wonder when there's not a lot of information about flights that go down, especially when there are families on board and you don't really hear about it. It's not really ever talked about. What was going on? I mean, how much history do we even know about during the Cuban Missile Crisis? Were there some covert operations we still haven't heard about?
Yeah.
Maybe there's a reason this plane went down. Anyways, I just found that really interesting. And the fact, yeah, 48 survived, maybe all thanks to Toby. Maybe Toby guided them in, this guardian angel, on his little raft.
And if it was her imagination or that angel effect trigger, how did she know which way to go? How did, you know,
the darkness? Yeah. Again, it could all be luck and could just be, you know, I don't know.
What do you think?
I think it was a CIA astral projection project.
Hmm.
So they purposely shot down this military contracted plane so they could test out Toby, who was an astral projector. Ooh. To see how many he could rescue.
We'll be getting into that next season. Well, should we tie it up with theories, thoughts?
Do it.
Do it.
All right. So the first thing I want to talk about, just before we kind of speculate at the end of this episode, the angel switch.
That was the brain mechanism, right? That allegedly projects these things.
Yeah. It comes from that switch that derives from that experiment with the shadow person.
Did we talk about that?
We did a little bit in the main episode, but we'll go over it a bit here. So this comes from Geiger's book. Each of the explorers and survivors in this book had, as Sir Ernest Shackleton put it, and I like this quote, quote,
"pierced the veneer of outside things."
They were engaged in an endeavor that pushed them to the bare limits, and they reached the point of sufficient extremity to have experienced an additional unaccountable companion on their journeys. And as he goes on to talk about how the third man's been called many things, tried to be explained by sensory illusion, hallucination caused by extreme conditions or monotony, ghostly apparitions, extrasensory perception potentially, and of course, manifestation of a guardian angel type figure. Okay, but here's one interesting thing that hadn't occurred to me when we were preparing for this episode, but is kind of a fun idea. So in Geiger's book, he says one explorer even confided to him privately that he had wondered at times whether this is, quote,
just one third man, a single entity,
who has through time intervened to help those most in need. He posed a question, quote,
have you ever found that this being has been in two places at one time?
I had to answer that I have not, and he nodded knowingly. I just thought that was kind of a cool thing to consider. It reminds me of like Quantum Leap, you know, like one person jumping around through time to make right what once went wrong. Like instead of this being, you know, internal mechanism or your own guardian angel, what if it's just one supernatural being that goes and tries to save
people? So.
It's a fun idea though.
It's silly.
Like a life-saving Santa Claus.
You don't know John.
I do.
Okay, so then we'll move on since that's a no-go for John. here's where Geiger goes on to more of a biological explanation.
I already know the answer.
From within.
He says, John, there's another quote coming up. It's a fart. That's the answer. You got another quote coming up.
It's the biological function.
Increasingly, that is where the evidence leads us, says Geiger, within us to a mechanism of the brain activated in those who cross the line of physical or psychological tolerance. The most recent scientific research is compelling.
Which is what we discussed on the Shadow Person episode. We'll have that linked.
By electrical stimulation of the left temporoparietal junction, the part of the brain involved in organizing sensory information, Olaf Blanke and his colleagues were able to evoke in the laboratory a presence in a 22-year-old woman who suffered from epilepsy. Each time they stimulated this area of the brain, the woman vividly felt the presence return. When they stopped, the shadow person abruptly departed. In the context of Blanke's research, this mechanism has been called a switch. For most people going about the business of everyday life, the capacity to access this power lies hidden and dormant. The switch remains off. But for some of those who reach the limit of endurance, either through some traumatic event or while doing the seemingly impossible, the switch is turned on. And it is suddenly and tantalizingly before them, a startling awareness of being in the presence of some ineffable good.
And Edmund Hillary had a great quote here. He says, quote,
"There is a benevolent being assigned to each of us on a permanent basis, who sometimes works in the background like a discreet family servant, but who sometimes emerges in response to specific needs, whether momentary as in a physical emergency or continuous, as in the case of childhood companions."
And then Geiger goes on to suggest, quote,
"This benevolent being exists not outside of us, but within. It is a real power for survival, a secret and astonishing capacity of the mind,
part of our social hardware. I call it the angel switch."
Boring.
I mean, so here's the thing. In the example there, Edmund Hillary, who is the Mount Everest conqueror, essentially, goes on to seemingly describe it as more supernatural, but that's something that's always with you, that's activated in those life-saving scenarios. It can be activated to save your life, but it sounds like it is like an angel type thing. It's not something that's just brain switch inside you, part of your mind.
Yeah.
But Geiger's suggestion there was that it's more biological.
Yeah.
That's his suggestion, but he goes on to then again question that idea. Okay. So he's not putting himself in one position or the other. And it reminds me again also of the accounts where there seems to be the secret knowledge. There seems to be where these presences seem to inhabit certain locations, not necessarily where it would make sense. So there's definitely more to consider there. But I thought it brought up an interesting thing, which is just basically the idea, if you could do this, let's say it was some sort of inner ability that everybody has, how incredible it would be if every one of us had this ability and knew how to access it. You'd never have loneliness. Think of how it would affect depression, stressful situations, anxiety, people who lose a spouse, things like that. You have the ability to
create a companion.
Yeah, to get over some challenges that might be almost impossible for some people to get over. If you could just go click and then suddenly someone's there that fills you with this feeling of love and encouragement when you most need it. I just thought it was an interesting thought that he had brought up. This is the last thought, and it goes to exactly what you were just saying about more than being the biological thing. It's how he ends his book, which I thought was important to read.
But is it only the brain that is involved? The third man impresses those who experience the phenomenon with the vivid belief that they have come into contact with an unseen being of compassion and beauty, and for some, a greater power. Paul Firth, the physician and climber who was joined by a third man on Aconcagua, argues that even if we accept prevailing neurological explanations for the third man, a mystery endures. A biological explanation does not preclude a benign metaphysical origin. An explanation of how does not answer the question of why.
We talked about that on the
That's why I thought you should read.
Whatever the physiological details of these experiences, who can say why these helpful ghosts wander in the penumbral world of the edges of our perception? Yes, an angel switch exists in the brain, but the fact that it is a brain response to extreme and unusual environments doesn't take away from the experience itself, which is still a potent force for survival. Richard Dawkins and other atheists seem to be arguing that religious or mystical impulses are somehow worthy of contempt. Yet here is something with every appearance of being a religious or mystical experience that can save your life. The third man represents something extraordinary. His appearance has always signaled a moment of transcendence over an explorer's adventures or survivor's immediate dire situation, The third man is an instrument of hope, a hope achieved by a recognition that is fundamental to human nature, the belief, the understanding that we are not alone.
Nice. And I thought a good way to end that. I mean, it's an uplifting message.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it, again, it goes back to the idea of it's something people are accessing, something that appears to them, and always the debate.
Yeah.
Specifically that experiment we talked about before, where it's the is it audio that triggers the awareness of this other, right? The switch that they called it.
The experiment did not specifically use sound, but rather it focused on conflicting sensory motor signals. In this experiment, participants were blindfolded and asked to interact with a robot. As they moved their hands, the robot mimicked these movements and touched the participants' back. The key to inducing the sensation of a foreign presence was creating a delay and spatial discrepancy in the robot's movements. This mismatch in sensory and motor cues led participants to feel as if there was another person behind them, copying their movements.
I think they even referred to it as like a shadow person, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't the idea that it was like your split consciousness creating kind of a doppelganger in the room connected with you?
The feeling of that presence. Yeah.
I don't remember that being benevolent. I remember that being like a almost made people anxious, a concern, like a negative kind of feeling.
Yeah. I'm not sure, honestly.
Okay.
You have to look into that.
Yeah. Anyways, I think that, yeah, it could be a different thing if that's the case, because obviously wouldn't have that warm companion. Like it's almost like a evil doppelganger creation through sound. But even then, is that your psyche or is that you are accessing?
Right. Just another realm.
The awareness. Yeah. Of like the, Are You Afraid of the Dark with the glasses?
Always reminds you of that. Yeah.
And there's just things around you that you can now see. Anyways, what do you guys think?
There's a lot out there at the edges of perception.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this adventure into the frozen mists.
Yes!
The rest of the season is going to blow your mind.
Yeah.
I've got a plan for some deep research, deep digger episodes.
Deep digger?
Yeah.
Some crazy corner, some fun.
Some adventure stuff, maybe?
Oh, absolutely.
That's kind of what this was a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Get your mind in a different place and maybe inspire a little, probing those questions of reality.
And really appreciate you guys supporting us and joining us in the hole. And much love to everybody.
Absolutely.
And looking forward to killer rest of the season.
Excellent. Yes.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio.
Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.